Hey, 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 this is Beer Sessions Radio. For the next few months, we're going on the road in the Empire State. I'm Jimmy Carboni. I've been working with beer for over two decades. Most of my work is in my bar, Jimmy's Number 43, in the East Village, or in the studio at the Heritage Radio Network as the host of Beer Sessions Radio. In my time, I've seen major changes in the craft beverage industry. There's a big movement right now to know where your food comes from and to consume local artisanal products. When I buy kale at the farmer's market, it's easy for me to feel part of this movement. But every time I enjoy a cold beer, I don't always think about where the beer comes from. And since I live in a city of 8 million people, I forget that beer, cider, and spirits are all agricultural products. This is the second episode in a very special series of Beer Sessions Radio. Over the next few months, I'm going to take you out of the studio and into the fields, malting houses, breweries, and distilleries of some of New York's best craft beverage producers. I'm really excited to have you on this journey. In our first episode, I visited the New Primitives of Hudson Valley, New York. The brewers we met were using methods from 100 years ago, and they were doing it together.
But when it comes to brewing, like Jake said, it's a family. We all work together, and we all grow together, and we are in an awesome community here, and I'm digging it. Love it.
In this episode, we're going a little further to the edge of the wild. We will take you to the Catskills region, just a few hours north of New York City. In this region, we found independent brewers, distillers, and cider makers. They had Wild West, do-it-yourself attitudes.
And that's exactly what I expected. We came off 17, and here we are in the middle of Wurstboro in the Catskills in New York. And it's just as I expected. As we drove up, two dogs came running out from Andy Brennan's house to meet us. And, you know, it's a perfect country setting here. And so we're going to get out and talk to Andy about cider here in Wurstboro, New York.
How you doing? Good to see you again.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. I forget you've been here before, right?
I've never been up here, man.
I thought you were maybe one of the tastings that Glenwood for us together.
I never came up. I needed an excuse to come up. Yeah. So we got a grant and we came up.
Our first stop is a very special place, Aaron Burr Cider. As you'll hear, not a lot of people get to visit. The cider maker is Andy Brennan.
The apples make the cider. I'm just, my job's not to fuck it up. That's all. So, yeah, hi, I'm Andy. Andy Brennan from Aaron Burr Cidery. We're in Wurstboro, New York. Right on the way on the D&H Canal, which used to connect the Delaware River to the Hudson River. And so this house has been here for almost 200 years. That's sort of what we were attracted to. We moved up here, really, because we like the history and the stone walls and the rural way of life.
I can't keep my focus here because there's so much to look at. It's the beautiful, you know, vista over here, and it's the Delaware and the Hudson canals down that way.
Yeah, it goes along the base, the backside of that Schwamgunk Ridge, and it goes from the Delaware River, which is 10 miles southwest of here, to the Hudson, which is about 30 miles east of here. And it's, you know, obviously they didn't want the canal to cross the mountain, so they picked the low point. And this road, which you probably hear, is 209, is actually one of the oldest roads in America. It was when the Dutch settled in Kingston, this was their old mine road. So they were getting copper and iron from literally right there. There's old mines right there. And it's considered to be the oldest commercial road in America for that reason.
I wanted to visit Andy because his cider is some of my favorite. Each batch of cider is so different because Andy uses all kinds of different native apples. His cider making process starts with apple growing.
Is there anyone that you look to for inspiration, or are you getting your stuff from books from the 19th century?
I'm not somebody who likes to be part of a movement. I don't look at other people's labels or marketing them, but hugely influenced by sort of romantic writings from the previous centuries, the 18th and 17th century, and 19th century, actually, especially the 19th century, people like Thoreau, who would write tremendous things about wild apples.
The era of the wild apple will soon be past. It is a fruit which will probably become extinct in New England. I fear that he who walks over these fields a century hence will not know the pleasure of knocking off wild apples. Ah, poor man, there are so many pleasures which he will not know.
But it doesn't even have to be apple-rated. Like, I love Wendell Berry. Some of his stories just make me want to just curl up in my orchard and mess with the trees and hide for as long as I can. But last night I was reading something by Wendell Berry. It made me think about what we have seemed to have lost during the 20th century and sort of this need to make money.
And then what, you know, there's a lot of lore about cider, and you touched on it. You talked about people throwing apples off their trains and trees growing. You know, was there a Johnny Appleseed? I know that there's been some writers who've written about it, but I want to hear it from your voice.
Well, there was a Johnny Chapman who they named Johnny Appleseed, and I would like to add, as somebody who now can relate to him on another level, is that he was religious, a deeply, deeply religious person. The apple tree was his symbol. It was the thing that he used to confirm that how we as humans could live in this world. So we are, in a sense, an artifice of nature as well. The apple tree isn't from this area. It was brought over by the settlers, the original settlers in the 1600s, but the apple tree escaped their farms and started to acclimate with the Northeast United States. And that was, I think, for Johnny Chapman, a real sign. That's what we should be looking to, and it's how we should be living our lives, that we not take over the United States, but to sort of acclimate to it. And it's sort of how we really should have been, or what he thought we should have been. Certainly Thoreau hints at this too. But anyway, that's not the way the 20th century played out. Literally, my first word was apple. I don't know what it is about me, because I didn't grow up on an apple farm. I grew up in the suburbs.
We walked up a steep slope behind Andy's farm. Every year, Andy presses apples to make cider. When he's done, he takes what's left over from the apple and spreads it on the slope behind his farm where we were standing.
You could kind of see that this is like an area that we threw the pumice. Like, these are old apple skins. These are apple trees. Look at this. There's no way in hell you're planting an apple tree there. That's not a rock. That's the earth. That's just pure ledge. And it's growing. Look at this. This is like right in this one area, 3 square inches. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 apple trees. Yeah, I just feel like I'm amongst people, the right people, quiet people, you know, that I'm an introvert, so I like to, I'm at a slower pace than I think most people. And apple trees are like people. The old trees are. So in the 90s, I was, I would have called myself a painter. That was my primary job, was painting. I was an artist, and I would spend the summers in the orchard painting. Being in an orchard like that made you feel like you're like at a Christmas party when you're a kid, and you're shorter than everybody. You're waist height, but you're like running around. Maybe you find another kid to play with, and you're operating at this lower level while everybody's like up there drinking their highballs and whatever the hell, you know, people drank in the 70s. And anyway, that's how I felt, and just in that orchard down in, this was in Maryland, by the way, and on the shore of the Chesapeake Bay. Turning 30, and like, what am I going to do with my life? And a girl I was dating, as you know, I was mad for, and we broke up. And then my cottage burned down. I mean, all these things were just, all my paintings were destroyed. Yeah, it was just one of those moments where it's like, what do I want to do? So when, in some ways, the developer did me a favor by destroying the orchard, because he gave me like the this is what you want to take from this experience. You want to, the orchard and the apple trees. Having those trees removed, like I couldn't get back the house, I couldn't get back the girlfriend, couldn't get back my paintings, but I could get back the apple trees. So I moved to New York, or I moved back to New York, and for 5 years I worked field of architecture and saved 80% of my checks for 5 years, and bought this property in 2006. Started planting apple trees. Painting's a good analogy, because painting, now painters start with a blank canvas, you know, literally a white square. But they used to paint on like walls like this, or, you know, and church walls or caves and stuff like that, and other cultures still do. And it was more that your work was part of the place. So anyway, I think the apple tree for Johnny Appleseed was sort of a mix of the apple tree and the place. Every little area should have a cider maker. We should all be trying to figure out what trees grow in those soils and how to best allow the tree to be what it wants to be in each area.
This is great. I mean, this is like a living laboratory. I mean, we're on this hill that you've cleared. You've put down pumice. There's apple trees growing everywhere, and you kind of self-select the ones that are getting bigger. You're wrapping in little protective devices, and it's kind of a paradise.
And we named, like, that's Harriet, that's Gertrude, there's Abigail, Bertha, Dolores, Clara, all these old names from, but we had to do it alphabetically. That's what A, B, C, D, and then we're up to H. So this tree, Harriet, that's Harriet, that's her tree. This tree has been dying, as you can see. It used to have another trunk that came out, and this side's it. So I took the graft wood from one of the alive branches, which is about this much, and I took it for radio. That's like 6 inches of the most recent growth, and I collected that in the winter, and then I grafted it onto this tree, which used to be a northern spy. So you could see where that graft union is here. So this...
It's like a scar on the bark. That's what it looks like.
So what I'm holding now is the wood from that tree. And this is now like 2 years old. So this actually might start fruiting. Whereas anything below that scar is...
So the branch itself, the bark and everything is totally different from its parent tree.
Yeah, but... So at this point, if this tree were to fruit over here, this would be Harriet. And if this were to fruit, this would be Northern Spy. And then if you see down here, these are little root suckers coming up. And if these were to turn into trees and fruit, these would actually be another kind of fruit. Because this Northern Spy starts right here at a graft from the nursery. So the tree root itself is a different tree. So you got 1, 2, 3 trees on this one living
and then
being.
You call that other tree Harriet. Is that because you found that tree on your property and you don't know, there's no other identification? Or?
Right. It's most certainly a seedling, given that it's growing on that. Well, you can't see it now, but it's a ledge right in that area.
Apple trees have to be grafted to get any kind of consistency. That's because, incredibly, every single apple seed is a completely new, unique variety of apple. So up on the slope is Annie's experiment, and down the hill are his grafted trees, where he knows what to expect. Andy is a pro at making cider with both kinds of apples, the expected and the unexpected.
Hey, let's can we taste some cider? You want to talk about
how
you make some cider? Switch, because, you know,
why don't we go to the basement for that? Because that's where the cider, this is all unfermented cider. Let me grab some cups, though.
Walking into an old barn, trying to get the character of every place that we visit. And this is another kind of farmhouse barn. And smells like cider.
Which
is a nice
here.
Thing.
This is our cold storage room, which still has tons of barrels in there. Yeah, I don't know if you could smell in there. It's, this just couldn't be the more. I mean, you could feel the temperature now. It never gets above, say, 60 in the summer, and it never gets below 40 in the winter. So it's perfect for fermentation and keeping things steady. Well. First, let me just say, the cider we just drank is exactly what cider in the barrel will taste like. It's dry, bone dry. There's absolutely no sugars left in it. It's what, 4 years old now? But it's still, and that really, I think, you know, I would like to see ciders return to. I see a lot more still ciders because I think you can pick up on some of the nuances and certainly some of the more sultry qualities of cider by drinking it still. Of course, we have to have the right apples, but still, this is how they would have drank it 200 years ago.
Question about the label, you know, Aaron Burr, you know, there's the gun, and you know, Hamilton's a really popular musical. The Aaron Burr connection, what is that connection with you, and why did you name?
So Aaron Burr in 1817 was the lawyer who sold this property from the Bayards of Manhattan to the Browns. That's what he did. He had no political career pretty much after he was shot Hamilton and tried for treason as well by Jefferson soon after. And so he was a lawyer, but he lived for another 30 years. He lived in Manhattan. This is among his ways of making a living was writing the deeds and selling the properties from, this was the Wild West at the time, so some of the lots were thousands of acres, so they needed to be divided up and surveyed, and you know he sort of wrote the legal record of this of a lot of properties up here, not just ours. But he represented a local history to the New York area, and from the time period, which I feel was imperative for cider, it was the height of cider, the early 1800s. So we wanted a name that was local and from that time period, and that's really what jumped out at us. The fact that he was the lawyer was on our property was the icing on the cake.
We came all the way to Worsboro, New York, which isn't too far from New York City, but it is in many ways very far away, and we're very happy to talk with Andy Brennan, Aaron Burr Cidery, and we walked up hills and hung out with dogs and talk philosophy while we drank some cider. So, all right, man.
Yeah, thanks, Jimmy. You're really a champion of so much, but you wouldn't be if you didn't have the passion.
we drove from Andy Brennan's farm in Wurstboro, and once we got on 17B, we saw the old Monticello Raceway and rundown old resorts and hotels. And once we got into White Lake and Bethel Woods, start seeing these beautiful old dairy farms and rolling hills. And as Andy said, we're on the plateau of the Catskills, and there's beautiful rolling hills. And we pulled up right across from the old where the Woodstock was. There's the Dancing Cat Saloon and the Catskills Distillery, and we're going to go in and check out this distillery out here in Catskills, New York, as we look into more of the edge of the wild.
All right.
Welcome all you strangers to the Great Divide.
I'm Monty Sachs, and I am from the Catskill Distilling Company here in Bethel, New York. We just got done with the first shift for the day. The second one is about to show up here any moment. Come on in. Pleasure, my friend.
It's good to see
you, man.
Nice
to see you again.
I tell you, the first thing I notice is the smell.
Well, that's because we've been rectifying and making whiskey all day. And now the second shift is coming in, and they are about to cook and strip. We're in the midst of, I think we're at 32 batches of bourbon so far. And we're going to continue making it until our new still gets here, which should be any moment, hopefully. You know, I was surprised when I cracked open the first barrel of whiskey, and I couldn't believe how good it was. It's amazing to me that I actually learned how to do this. Just, you know, this is a craft and an art that generally gets passed from generation to generation. I was just in the right place at the right time with the right man to teach me. This is complex. So, like you said, when I had met you, Jimmy, and I just had that vodka, and quickly realized that vodka was not going to pay the bills. So I began to look for someone to teach me how to make whiskey. And, you know, this industry is full of charlatans, but they're all experts. I found the fellow who had just retired from Brown & Forman. His name was Lincoln Henderson, one of the greatest distillers that the world had ever seen. He not only was their master distiller, he consulted for every major whiskey company, actually alcohol beverage company in the world. Lincoln was the coolest, and the chemist. And I don't believe Lincoln ever taught anyone outside of the industry. So I got his number, called this poor guy up at home, freaked him out, but we talked. And, you know, I tried to engage him, and he wanted to talk technical, and it's right up my alley. So we spoke for a couple hours. He finally invited me down to spend a few days with him in Kentucky. And I guess he liked me because he decided to teach me how to do this. And the whiskeys that I make are the result of the tutelage of Lincoln Henderson. He was brilliant. He was a Bourbon Hall of Famer. They called him the living legend of bourbon. Well, he was alive, unfortunately passed away a couple of years ago. But he was the coolest of the cool.
What was the first lesson he taught you?
Well, he taught me this is complex. You know, to make good whiskey is not an easy thing to do. Make whiskey simple. To make whiskey you want to drink is not so simple. The point is that I just had a plan from Lincoln and how it needed to be done. But no one had ever really done it before. So I just figured it out. It was something that he had done research on when he was affiliated with Brown & Forman. And on an industrial scale, it is very cost prohibitive. But on my scale, it works great. And it's very possible that that was one of the reasons why Lincoln actually wanted to teach me, is because he wanted to see how it worked in practice. And it works great.
And what was his feedback on your whiskeys?
Lincoln passed away before we actually even released any whiskeys, unfortunately. Within 2 months, he passed away 2 months before we had released the first bourbon. Such is life.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful country. As we drove out, we drove by the old dairy farms, and we remarked that it was almost too perfect, some of these farms.
Pretty idyllic, you might say. This is a great project and a great place to do it. This is where everyone came from the city. We were close to Manhattan, and, you know, the Catskills were famous for producing all the comedians, Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis. They all came here to perform. The boxers of the time all came here to train. This was the place to be. And that was late 50s into, I think, early 60s. And then people started getting on airplanes. And then they didn't need to come to the Catskills anymore. It was just as easy to drive to the airport, get on a plane, and a few hours later, you're in a totally different place. And that began the decline of the hotels. Of big hotels that are left up here, there's really only one, unfortunately. I came to this area because of horses. I'm a horse vet, and, well, at least I was. And I came to this area because there's lots of horses here for me to work on. I came to this area to work in for a very special horse doctor who was very well known in the country. We're a referral practice. We were doing 300 and something table surgeries a year, as well as it was a large reproductive practice. It was the largest area in New York for standard bred breeding. So as a young veterinarian, I'd see four or five new babies a day. I thought I had died and gone to heaven. It was unbelievable. No, it's really all about, you know, my background in chemistry to get into vet school and pharmacology. You know, you begin to understand the interactions of different chemicals. And, you know, I was surprised to learn that this is very similar to that. But it is, you know, this is just a big chemistry set. You know, I just didn't realize as a retirement plan that this business was going to be as successful as it is. You know, we buy none of our spirits. Everything that we sell, we make from scratch. And we pride ourselves on that. We make spirits for some other distilleries, but everything that we sell under our name is made here, every drop.
The smell is great, I'll tell you that. Yes. I'm always getting a little buzz just from the smell.
If you want to get a little buzz, we can go into the barrel house. You'll get a big buzz.
Let's go there. Let's
okay.
Show
Come
me
on.
That.
Yeah, I'm really over the farmer thing. I spent most of my life on farms. Being a farmer is not really what I had in mind. Come on, you. Open up. We had our distributor here this morning from Italy. And he was in, they were here taking pictures for their catalog. Anyway, very hot in here.
So tell us about this program, because this is pretty amazing. I see wheat whiskey in these barrels.
I make four types of aged whiskey. I make a bourbon, I make a wheat whiskey, I make a rye, and I make a spirit that actually I call a whiskey, but the government does not. We're the only ones in the country that make it. It's made from buckwheat, and it is extraordinary. It is unlike anything anyone has ever made and does really well. Actually, all of our whiskeys do well.
So this is a really hot rum, and the smell of the whiskey is kind of overpowering with it. Yeah.
Yeah, well, we have
just outside with the door open.
We have a proprietary method for aging our whiskey. Whereas in Kentucky, you know, their rack houses are very tall, and they'll rotate barrels from the top to the bottom because they're hot on top, cold on the bottom. These barrels are all the same temperature. So we cycle them in temperature monthly from a bottom temperature to a high top temperature. And so in a period of 2 years, which is why our whiskeys are all straight whiskeys, we can produce a whiskey that I feel is like 5 or 6 year old whiskey.
This room heated.
What do you think? This is very heated.
What is it, about 100 degrees in there?
I think it's a little bit more than 100 actually at the moment. But this is not the highest temperature. It gets a lot hotter than this.
So you have like temperature fluctuation.
We vary temperature. This is computer controlled.
It's almost like you took your barrels, put them on a ship, and had them sail around the equator for a couple of years.
No, very different, because they get hot and then they get cold. It is not a constant hot temperature. Th- this is unlike anything that anyone has ever made. But like I said, it can't be called whiskey because buckwheat is not a grain. This is unique, actually, worldwide. There's only me and this other fellow that make this stuff. This is a very difficult product to make. Buckwheat is not cooperative. As it turns out, this is a great business, but a very bad retirement plan.
Well, you're working hard, man, I'll tell you that. I mean, you know, you start out, Monticello Racetrack is nearby, and that's...
It was. I worked there for 20 years.
So you really know the area well.
You know, I know the area fairly well now, although I did come to Woodstock as a kid. I hitchhiked here from Connecticut, and just by, I guess, good karma, I ended back up here. Yeah, I hitchhiked here. I grew up in Branford, Connecticut. And, you know, that was a very interesting summer. It was 1969. And, you know, I had been traveling with my cousin. We had gone to the Newport festivals. And then we heard about this and we decided to come up here. So neither one of us had a car. We hitchhiked. And we hitchhiked right basically in front of the distillery here. And it was an extraordinary experience. And that really began to open my eyes to what goes on in the world, or what could go on in the world. This was beyond comprehension. You know, I remember, you know, lying in bed at that age wondering about life, what life was going to be. I had no idea.
After visiting Monty, we drove to the heart of trout fishing country in Roscoe, New York. It was dark when we got there, but when we woke up, we could see the natural beauty of the place, trees and rivers. We went to the nearby town of Livingston Manor. There we found the site of the Catskill Brewery. We met Randy Lewis, one of the three owners.
Hey, Randy.
All right, sir.
Jimmy Carboni, nice to see you.
You too. How you doing? And I am Randy Lewis, one of the partners in the brewery.
Back to when you started. You know, how many years ago did the planning start?
And also, listen,
why Catskills also?
So,
a brewery in this area.
So that was number one. There was no brewery in the area, and all of the partners, collective partners, wanted to start a business that would be fun. We love beer. So that was a good place to start. Listen, we thought about a distillery at the time, but then we thought, well, wait a second, we could have a bigger impact on the local economy, creating jobs, creating a destination that would bring people here. And that was, I think, kind of the key part of our thinking. The three principal partners all have day jobs, so we were trying to do something for the area that would have an impact, you know, for several generations and be sort of exponential growth and impact on the local economy. You know, you see now through the heavier seasons, which is spring, summer, and fall, we're obviously quieter in the wintertime, but the amount of tourists that are coming to the area, coming to our town, supporting local businesses is so meaningful that in a year and a half it could probably be measured.
Randy's a huge fan of trout fishing. That's why he first started coming to the area. So when he built the Catskill Brewery, he wanted it to be the lowest possible impact on the environment.
So we set out to build essentially the greenest building possible. We had a target of being LEED Platinum, Leadership in Engineering and Environmental Design. We are in certification process now, which should be a few more months, and we expect to achieve the highest level, which is platinum. But really, it wasn't when we were doing it, it wasn't necessarily the goal. We just decided with everything we did, weigh the green option against a conventional building option and pick one. You know, if the cost wasn't significantly different, then we'll pick the green option. So almost everything we did, whether it's wood on the walls, the flooring, the lighting, everything was a green environmental decision. Now we have brought schools through the place, showed them some of the things, you know, how green technology works, geothermal heating, cooling, which does, aside from providing the heat in the building, provides the air conditioning next door in the office, provides the cooling for the coolers. We have a solar PV system, which, you know, is now becoming more and more common for electricity. And then we have a solar hot water system, which we use to back up geothermal for heating and cooling, but also preheating brew process water. You know, our plan is to put all of this stuff online on a website, even live data from our solar PV system, solar hot water system, a schematic of how the geothermal system operates, so they can kind of see this stuff. But, you know, it just makes, you know, kids think a little broader about, you know, the choices. You know, every day we're hearing about global warming and this kind of stuff. So I'm not suggesting that we made all the right decisions, but we made decisions that will help inform others.
I was here in 2011 for an event, and that's when I first got turned on to anti-fracking movement. And we did know about Mark Ruffalo. We were involved with something called Chefs for the Marcellus for a few years. And I know that Mark was one of the leading advocates, you know, for not fracking, and influenced Governor Cuomo. So I know a lot about it, but maybe you can say more. I don't know if you want to say more about it, if that's in your interest or not, because if it's not.
Well, listen, we were successful in New York State in defeating fracking and keeping it out of New York State, at least for the time being. One of my partners, Ramsey Adams, is an environmental advocate and runs the Catskill Mountain Keeper, which was at the very front lines of the fight against fracking. But at the end of the day, everybody knows what fracking is, and the, you know, pro or con, you know, we all have our opinions. Obviously, we want to protect. We're all about the environment. We are obviously anti-fracking. But more importantly, here in the Catskills, it's about the water. You know, we supply the drinking water to New York City. New York City is known to have some of the best drinking water in the world. Water is the key ingredient in beer. And with good water, you should be able to make good beer, and that's exactly what we've done. That was kind of a focus of the project to begin with, is highlight, feature the Catskill water. The water that provides the drinking water in New York City comes from the Papacton Reservoir. That is about 15 miles from here. It's about 4 miles from my house. And again, you won't find better water many places in the world. And that's something that needs to be protected. Well, sure. You know that when they are drilling fracking wells, they are going down as deep as plus or minus 8,000 feet. So in that process, obviously, you're going through a number of different aquifers, but you're going below them to ultimately pull gas out from deep in the ground, the deposits. But in the process, what has happened, and they believe has happened in Pennsylvania and I think some other places around the country, is they end up releasing gas that will find its way up into the upper aquifers, water aquifers. So that's where the contamination, the risk of contamination to water occurs.
And there's also a lot of water used in the fracking process as well. And then there's the issue of the waste. When that comes up, there's chemicals like benzene, really toxic chemicals that have never really been the full, I think it's a trademarked or patented chemical solution that's used. I don't think it's ever been fully released what exact chemicals are in that fracking solution.
Is really for us, it's all about the water, right? You know, it's as simple as that. We are protecting the water. Our business is all about the water. Without good water, we can't make good beer. You know, we're doing that. We want to protect it. But at the same time, you know, from a sort of a principle and value perspective, you know, I want the proliferation of renewable energies, you know, throughout the country, the world. If this place is a starting point, you know, something that perpetuates that, perfect.
I mean, okay, only back in 2011, when I came up to this part, Sullivan County, Bethel, and West, you would see signs for fracking and against, neighbor versus neighbor. And some of the people here, it wasn't a bad, you know, incentive for some people to lease their lands to these energy companies. And considering the other, you know, economic opportunities around here, if you own land, be able to lease your land for money was not a bad idea. The problem with fracking is that the potential risk of any type of, you know, pollution or water contamination, it's also the identity of the region. You're trying to build it around farm to table,
agriculture, craft products like beer and tourism versus, oh, short-term selling of our energy rights. Well, in an area that's already depressed, it's not going to make anyone want to move here. It's not going to help property values go up. So I think in the end, New York State made the right choice in favor of tourism and craft beverages. And the government, I think, has done the right thing. He's really pushed for craft beverage laws like the farm brewery licenses. And that's great, man. It makes a lot of sense. Now I understand you have the background, the skills to do something like this. Because you really are, like I said, 2011, it was either fracking or anti-fracking. And I feel like this county was on the verge. And I feel like that what you guys are doing is pushing this county in the right direction, you know, for life and economy. And, you know, I think you're a real asset, man. So I'm glad you built a brewery. Instead of an amusement park or something.
Thanks, me too, because all of this, all of our hard work, you know, builds our thirst. And thirst needs to be quenched.
Why don't we sit down and taste some beers?
Water, the most forgotten of beer's four ingredients. As we drove from the Catskill Brewery to even further west, we passed where Catskill Brewery gets its water. It's the Papacton Reservoir. That's also where my water comes from at my apartment in New York City. So it's really these brewers we have to thank for the high quality drinking water we get in the city.
We're on the edge of the wild, Beer Sessions Radio on the road. So we drove a little farther and we crossed up into Delaware County. We're up in Walton, and it seems like we're, you know, farther in the Catskills, but it's a nice old town. Another one of these really great old small cities that at one time probably had manufacturing and had a lot of trade with New York City. So we're going to talk to Cheryl Linz at the Delaware Phoenix Distillery, and I know she knows some of the history of this town, and she's one of the new producers here that's actually doing something, and it's quite unusual that she chose to make absinthe. At the time, was the only maker in New York State making absinthe, and we're going to find out really from her what the business is like and, you know, the type of work she has to do up here in the Catskills area of New York, being a craft beverage producer. So here's Cheryl Linz now. We're on the old Main Street, Railroad Avenue in Walton, New York, and we're going to come in and say hi to Cheryl. You know, first impressions of walking in to this space is the smell.
Oh, and it's, thank you.
What are we smelling? Because there's so many great flavors in the air.
Well, what it depends on what you're actually picking up on. You could be picking up on the yeast of the fermentation that's going on right now. That could be one thing. If there's an anise aroma, that's from making absinthe, which is the other thing I make. I make various whiskeys, bourbon, rye whiskey, corn whiskey, and aged wheat whiskey, and I make a couple different absinthes. So you could also be smelling this, these ferments going on.
Well, there is a lot in there, but definitely I smelled the anise when I walked in. That was So tell us about this place and how you came to be here.
The basic idea was I'd been drinking absinthe, discovered that in 2006. It was only available in Europe, wasn't available here in America. And so you had to order it online, and it was very expensive. And so over time, it was either, well, I guess I should just give this up because I was just had a kind of not very well-paying job at the time and said, well, I'll just stop this, or I discovered that, oh, you can actually get a little pot still from Portugal. Oh my gosh, I can try and make it and we'll see what happens. So anyway, I kind of worked on that for about 6-7 months, and eventually people that I knew started liking what I was making over the commercial absinthe that I'd been getting from Europe. And these were, you know, the high grade commercial absinthe. They weren't the fake ones with, you know, artificial colorings and flavorings. So I was like, really? So anyway, one thing led to another. We had a terrible flood here in Walton in 06 as well, that a lot of people thought the town wouldn't be here. Several of the major businesses that were here were nearly destroyed, but they both chose to come back. And so there was nearly three feet of water in this building at that time. So it looked like a nice little building, and I thought, well, let's, you know, the job situation isn't so great. And here we are in Delaware County, where you basically have to create your own job. And so I figured, well, let's see what happens. So I didn't know how hard it would be to start a distillery. So it took about 18 months. to go through all the permitting process. There was some, you know, there was a lot of support here at Walton, but there was also some opposition. Walton was dry from 1845 till about 1965. You know, we have 13 churches in Walton, and people from one church came by to the various zoning meetings because in the zoning code in Walton that they instituted in the 80s, they said no distilling of beverages. You could have a fuel distilling facility over in the kind of industrial section of town, but no distilling of beverages. You could open a brewery, no problem. Distilling, So I had to get a zoning variance, and they kind of fought that. And they were, you know, they thought, oh, it'd be fine. Someone asked, oh, can you, what if someone put a gun shop right here on Main Street? And they're like, oh, yeah, that's fine. You know, but they kind of also saw it as, you know, maybe that I was, might have been a moonshiner or something like that, which was never true. And why aren't you up in the hills? It's like, well, this is a legitimate business.
What is the myth about wormwood? I mean, I don't really understand, first, what it is and why it was ever considered not safe. Or...
Yes, those are really good questions. Wormwood is a plant in the Artemisia genus. There's about 125 plants, different individual species in this broad category of wormwoods. And it was a medicinal plant going back to at least Roman times. So mostly for stomach ailments, probably because back then people actually had intestinal worms, and there actually is a chemical in it that is effective in, you know, killing them. So, but it's very, very bitter plant. So that may even be some of the origin of the term, taking the bitter with the sweet, because you would have had to have added sugar or honey or something in a big dose to actually, you know, kind of knock back some of that bad flavor. So the original production of absinthe was as a medicinal type of medicine back in the late 18th century. But it was basically alcoholism. That was what got absinthe a bad rap in the late 19th century, early 20th century. There was such a huge problem with drinking, not only in France and around Europe, but also in the U.S. It's kind of the beginning of the women's movement, too, of, you know, tired of having men come home drunk and, you know, beating up on their wives or whatever. And it's like, hey, you know, let's put a stop to that. So it was really seen as a very bad thing. They did not understand alcoholism as a disease until the early 20th century. So it was, in France especially, absinthe was the drink that the temperance movement in Europe demonized, just like whiskey was demonized here and gin was demonized in England. And so that was really the thing. It was, and people have done research now, kind of looking back at the past descriptions of people's problems. When they say they had someone who had absinthism. And they go, this really isn't any different from severe alcoholism, you know, when you have the DTs and go into withdrawal and you see the pink elephants and all that sort of stuff. So none of us have ever experienced that. You know, that era is long gone, but...
The three martini lunches. And...
Exactly. So that was really where it came from. In 1915... the French banned absinthe during World War I when they were losing to the beer-drinking Germans. And so they said, wait a minute, the Germans are at the gate. All the troops want to do is drink absinthe in the trenches. You have to ban this stuff. So they finally did after trying for many years. So that was kind of the history of absinthe as far as that went, and it disappeared for till the 90s, started to surface again, old bottles. You know, someone would find an old bottle. What's the absinthe? I've heard of that. And they'd kind of like finding an old bottle of wine. They'd open it back up. Oh, this actually isn't bad. In America, absinthe was never banned. Wormwood was never banned. What they started doing in 1906 with the Pure Food and Drug Act was the U.S. had an agency. It was the predecessor of the USDA, but they were very they were at the forefront of scientific analysis of beverages and food. America was quite a leader. And they developed a test. The belief at that time was that the cause of the danger of wormwood, which we now know to be alcoholism, was they thought it was a chemical called thujone, and that chemical is in wormwood. So they said, well, gee, if we regulate that, people can do what you want. So they ended up developing a little test, a very fancy kind of lipness test, and that they could use to test something, whether it had thujone in it or not. Of course, the test was wrong a lot. It had a lot of false positives. It was very simple and basic. We're talking 1906. Top of the line technology for 1906. And so basically absinthe was, well, you don't pass, so you don't get in. So that's really what it was. There were probably some absinthe-like products that were made without wormwood. So, of course, those would pass. That probably is the story behind, you know, the things that you've heard. Some people also say, oh, the absinthe in Europe are more authentic than the American was. Well, that's not true either. So, you know, I'm using, you know, the same type of ingredients, very similar distillation protocols. You know, my absinthe is just as authentic as anything coming out of Europe. I've had pre-ban, so I can at least say I know what it was like. Basically, the way absinthe traditionally was done with adding water. So I like about 4 parts water to 1 part absinthe. I kind of got a fairly big pour there, but anywhere from 3 to 5, and a lot of it's personal preference. I use a lot of anise in my production, so I don't believe it's necessary for there to be any need for sugar with my absinthe. It's going to be totally sweet enough as it is. And ideally, I would have put this maybe in my freezer and let it chill a little more, but I just got this from the tap. We have pretty cold tap water here. You do want pretty clean water. While New York City gets its water from here in this area and from our reservoirs, and it's really good, so we're just going to slowly dribble water into the glass. And now it's starting to go milky. And the situation there is what we have happening is that we have the chemical anethol, which is a part of anise, is falling out of solution because it's more alcohol soluble than water soluble. So it's coming out of solution and being all milky, and it louches, this French word meaning dirty or kind of shifty, shifty-eyed person, that kind of mean-looking person on the corner. He's louche. He's a loose person. Has that cigarette hanging outside of his mouth, gives you the dirty eye, like, Anyway, that's kind of what it is. So I'm just use this little cup with this cold water, and I slowly poured it in. I didn't just dump it in. Just slowly poured it in and went from there. So let me see. I'm going to have to give it a quick taste.
Release the flavors. You can smell the anise in the air.
Yes. Now, personally, I would like this a little colder just because it then warms up as it goes. But this is perfectly fine.
I like a cold drink. Watch. Okay. I'll break out into French. Joie de vivre! Hey, everybody, roll out the barrel! This would be like a crazy party. Wormwood got to my brain. Oh, no. I'm afraid to taste it.
No, it'll be fine.
It's really not a strong drink. You're putting 1 part absinthe to what? 4 parts water?
Right, exactly. So you're getting it down to maybe like strength of brandy. Yeah, maybe glass of wine, something like that. And back in the day, too, this is another issue. If these guys are sitting at the cafe watching the day go by, and they're drinking absinthe after absinthe. They've had 5 ounces or whatever of like 136 proof booze in them. You're going to get pretty plastered on that. It doesn't matter what, how much water you added.
Well, I'm really excited. This is my first absinthe, and I get to have it with
Cheryl. Thank you. I'm honored. Thank you very much, Jimmy.
Our Delaware Phoenix Distillery. It's called Walton Waters.
Exactly. With the waters, we got the herbs, all the anise and fennel don't grow here in New York. They're really more southern climate types of things, so I have to bring those in from Italy and Turkey. But the wormwood, hyssop, lemon balm, the three kind of main herbs within absinthe, I have all grown here for me. So you really can't, and you have to harvest it special, and it really is a unique thing.
Asante.
Thank you.
Thank you so
Merci
much.
Merci beaucoup.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to another episode of Beer Sessions Radio on the Road. If you want to visit the Catskills region and the craft beverage makers profiled in this radio special, check out the Escape Maker package on heritageradionetwork.org. Special thanks to the craft beverage producers we met in this episode. Andy Brennan from Aaron Burr Cider, Monty Sachs from Catskill Distilling, Randy Lewis from Catskill Brewing, and Cheryl Linz from Delaware Phoenix Distillery. We also want to thank Dana Ball of Upward Brewing Company, Donna Vallone of Creekside Cabins, the Roscoe Brewery, Main Street Farm Cafe, and the Arnold House. This episode was hosted by me, Jimmy Carboni. It was produced and recorded by Caitlin Pierce with help from Harry Huggins. The episode was engineered, mixed, and scored by David Tadashore, with editorial oversight by Aaron Fairbanks, all for the Heritage Radio Network. Thanks for listening.